Welcome to the Badlands, that overlooked place where philosophical thought runs into the political concerns of the day. Hello and welcome to the Badlands Politics and Philosophy Podcast. I'm Toby Napolitano, and with me this week, after a long break, we got Assistant Professor Hannah Gunn. How's it going, Hannah?
We're using titles now?
Just for you. You're the only one with a good one. also with us, a man who really looks pretty good in a full-size Dalmatian costume, Michael Hughes. How's it going, Michael?
Not too bad. Thanks, I guess.
Yeah. No, it was good. I assumed it was so you, it, obviously Halloween was a couple weeks ago. You went out as a Dalmatian. Your wife was Cruella de Vil. I assume this was really high-level commentary on the plight of the working class. Capitalist masters literally trying to take the skin off your backs.
I just like the outfit.
You just like the movie. Yeah. Well, so the way you were supposed to react to that was to say, Toby, you weren't supposed to talk about that on the podcast. This is private information.
Oh. I assumed that regardless of what I wanted, you were just going to plow ahead anyway. So.
Yes, in fact, if anyone wants to see the picture, DM us on Twitter. No, I won't go that far. No. Oh, so now there's a privacy concern. I see. Well, that nice segue leads us to the topic of this episode. Though I guess before we get there, I should always just thank people for listening and encourage you, if you have not, to give us a 5-star rating on iTunes, give us a review if you'd like. All of those things would help us out a lot. But as I suggested, the topic for the next couple of episodes is going to be privacy. So there's a great quote from the philosopher Judith Jarvis Thompson in her paper on privacy. She says this: "Perhaps the most striking thing about the right to privacy is that nobody seems to have any clear idea what it is." Period. And that seems right. And she wrote that in the 70s, I believe. That still seems true today. That actually is going to be the topic for our next episode. We'll be talking about rights to privacy. But we thought it would be good to start with questions about, well, before we talk about rights, why should we care about it in the first place? What's the value of privacy and how is it being threatened? And then next time we can talk about what rights we might have with respect to privacy. So that's going to be our topic for today. You know, lots of people, you know, there's lots of talk, obviously, about concerns about privacy. But I think for a good portion of the population, as you guys will detail, the response is like, whatever. So there's kind of a need to motivate the topic and say why we should care at all. So maybe we start first by just saying, what do we mean by privacy? For our purposes, I think we can just think of it as the ability to protect and control information about you. All sorts of facts, like things about where you live, what you do, contents of your diary, pictures of you, what you buy, who you talk to, etc., etc. Right? There can be lots and lots of things that we might think we have or we should have privacy over. So let me submit this question to our panel of experts here. Do you, Michael and Hannah, think that in our lovely, friendly, modern world that there are threats to our privacy?
No, it's fine.
Oh. Okay.
At this point, Michael's just given up on privacy. It's easier to take the attitude of it's just not worth worrying about. Because if one takes the attitude of caring.
No. So he's actually anticipating the eventual satirical spinoff of this podcast, which will be The Good Lands, where we just talk about how great everything is and how everything's fine. It's perfect.
Maybe that can be the April edition of the podcast.
The Good Lands?
The Good Lands.
Dude, that's a great idea.
Yeah.
We should do that.
That is a really good idea.
Gotta write that down.
Well, to all the listeners, stay tuned for April.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you're bullshitting me.
Yes.
So please answer the question sincerely this time.
All right. So, I mean, there are a lot of reasons to be concerned about privacy. One way that we can do a quick tour across various areas that one might care about privacy is just to list off various important domains in our lives and ask, well, I mean, are there any risks to privacy that people have noted and those kinds of demands. So we can start with just in public. So when you're in public, obviously there are things like CCTV and security cameras. These are things we don't tend to talk about as privacy issues anymore. I think most people accept that there is CCTV and security cameras all over the place, so they don't really see them as threats. But it's worth remembering that that's still pretty recent. And when things like CCTV were being installed for the first time, there was a lot of controversy about the idea that public places would be surveilled. But of course, now this is getting a lot more sophisticated. So in the US, at least, public spaces may also be surveilled by what are called smart lamps. So these are streetlights with microphones and security cameras in them. All sorts of stores and shopping centers and stuff are going to have video surveillance. But lots of public spaces that are businesses will also do things like monitor customers' activity through loyalty cards and various other ways that they'll try to keep tabs on what people are doing, what the public is doing when they're interacting with those stores.
And then we get sweet deals.
And then you get sweet deals, yeah.
Sometimes.
Or the opposite.
Yeah, or the opposite. So actually, the store thing goes two ways, right? One thing that loyalty cards do is they can give you targeted discounts. They also subtly do these, I can't remember the name of it right now. Michael, can you remember what it's called? It's like individual price inflation. So certain customers will actually have the prices for items that they're buying put up where other people have them put down. Okay, but thinking about other demands. So like if you were an employer or at your place of work, you're also being surveilled. Security cameras again. But then we're getting more sophisticated tools. The last few weeks, there's been an article about Domino's Pizza in New Zealand and Australia. They've been working on an algorithm with a camera attached that actually looks at the pizzas as they're being made. And so it does like real-time pizza surveillance. It's called like the Dom Pizza Checker, something like this.
The Dom Pizza Checker?
Yeah, the Dom Pizza Checker.
That's weird.
Well, Domino's is a long word, right?
Well, yeah, but it's also like domination, right? Like
I haven't thought about it that way.
That's where I went. Surveillance and domination.
So, I mean, that's one specific example of various kinds of workplace surveillance technologies that can be more or less sophisticated. They're looking at what employees are doing when they're at work, how productive they're being, how much time they're spending off task, stuff like that. Similar tools of that sort are also used in schools. Schools also have security cameras, but they also increasingly are having electronic classrooms where all the students will be on computers. And often this can come with software that allows teachers real-time access to what students are looking at on their computers, whether they're on task or off task, that kind of stuff. Schools and workplaces as well also hiring third-party companies to monitor our social media accounts. So they might be looking for specific keywords of interest to do like threat assessment. They can also just be sort of monitoring in general, like the mental health of students by looking at what they're posting on social media. And then those companies will report back to schools. We've also learned very recently that there are some universities, at least, and we're going to talk about this one a little bit more in depth, that are engaging in this kind of monitoring and surveillance of internet behavior for potential students. So not actual students yet, but people who might
not
be
even
considering...
people who have applied yet, but people who are considering or might consider
applying
to the school.
And obviously this is getting us closer to the next domain, right? So public, work, school, home, in-house security cameras, right? So security cameras are a constant, but increasingly people are having, security cameras in their homes. In addition to this, they have smart speakers. So you've got audio surveillance along with video surveillance. Then we also just have our phones and our computers. These have all kinds of tools that can be used for surveillance and monitoring, GPS in your phone, the apps you have on your phone, looking at what you're doing on the other apps on your phone, right? And most generally, just the internet. I mean, the short way to put privacy concerns on the internet is, oh, it's just all of it, right? there's not really pretty much anything that you, as the average user of the internet, pretty much everything you're doing can or is being surveilled by someone.
Okay, so regardless of the question of whether any of these kinds of surveillance or restrictions on privacy are justified, we can note that there is an unprecedented shrinkage of our privacy, our ability to control information about us, you said, in public, at work, at school, at home, on the internet. I guess the next step is we need, like, intra-surveillance. Like, I need to be able to surveil myself, and then it'll be complete, right?
But we do that, right? This is people sleeping with their Fitbits and stuff so they can see how they're moving in their sleep.
Well, I want real-time video, though.
You could.
Maybe I can monitor my organs or something as well, just to make sure everything's working okay.
Well, we can do that with some things. But yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you could definitely do that.
Yeah, no, I know. Well, just have a drone. Have one flying above you, and then have one on a little cart that can just, you know, walk around in front of you, and then get some Google Glass. I'm sure they're quite cheap to purchase now because it was a failed experiment. And then you can have an augmented reality display of yourself.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Thanks. Well, okay, so there's a lot there, to say the least. Clearly, there are many areas where we should at least wonder about these restrictions on privacy. And again, which isn't to say they're unjustified. Maybe they are justified. We'll get to that. But I guess as I was saying before, and I know, Hannah, you've thought about this a lot and talked to people a lot, the general reaction most people have is apathy, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, so I've... The first time I ever gave a presentation on privacy was because I was so frustrated at getting the nothing to hide argument response from my peers at grad school, which was, you know, I wasn't doing anything particularly extreme to defend my digital information privacy. I was, you know, using a password manager and actually reading some of the terms and conditions on apps before I would install them. And so I had declined to use some efficiency and productivity tools for some groups I was a part of because for some reason the timetabling software also wanted access to all of my contacts, text messages, call history, photos,
DNA sequence,
everything, right? I'm like, yeah, I don't think we need this. I'm gonna use this piece of paper with a pen.
Okay so the password manager is a good example, and I think this is really common. So a common response, if you say, you know, I use a password manager because I'm worried about security on the internet, a lot of times people respond by saying, or the reaction they will have is, yeah, that seems like a little bit of effort. And I really don't see, like I get it. I mean, it's whatever, things can happen, but it's not really harming me. It's not really affecting me. So it's not even worth the little effort I have to make to protect my security online.
Yeah, quick interjection. Actually, the most common response is, what's a password manager?
Fair enough.
So just for listeners, so it's one of the things that's really annoying, right? So you have all these online accounts and you have to have all these passwords. And it's really cumbersome to have to come up with all these new passwords. And so a lot of people just default to using the same password or the same few passwords, and they'll just alter a couple of letters or something like that. So what a password manager does is a password manager generates random passwords for all of your accounts and stores them in an encrypted manner. A safe way, so not a plain text document on your computer where you've got all of your passwords written out, as I know many people, unfortunately, still do this. And then provided you've got your password manager logged in, you remember that one password, password manager will fill all of your passwords for you. So you don't need to remember them, keeps them all unique. A fair number of them can auto-update all your passwords, that kind of stuff. So once you tell people that, then they will say, oh yeah, but then I have to create a password manager. Oh, and then I have to go to all my websites and change all the passwords.
By the way, this is one of our first legitimate opportunities for sponsorship, so let's not say anything bad about password managers. That's a good plug. So provided they even understand what you're talking about, there's this sort of apathy response because they don't see how it affects them, and so it's not particularly worth the effort. So maybe, and so you mentioned a nothing to hide argument, which is, I think, a manifestation of this kind of attitude. And it typically comes up in the context of surveillance and often government surveillance and the context of justifying surveillance in the name of security. And a lot of the things that you mentioned before were security cameras everywhere, right? So this is a kind of restriction on privacy in the name of security. And then often we engage in these trade-offs where we say, well, you know, we're willing to restrict some degree of privacy in the name of security. And there's a question of, right, whether that's justified or not. But so this I have nothing to hide argument is interesting. So the claim is like, right, so the government is going to engage in some kind of surveillance in order to enhance national security. And the response is something like, well, I have nothing to hide, so I don't see how this affects me. And as long as no one else has anything to hide, like, they shouldn't care either. Chill out, Snowden. What's the problem?
Yeah, and the Snowden piece is important there because it was around the time of Snowden's revelations about the United States government's pervasive surveillance program that a lot of people started paying more attention to privacy. Unsurprisingly, right? It's one of these things that, as we say, if people are generally apathetic, it takes some kind of event to get people invested in caring again. And so a lot of the discussions that even have been happening around privacy have very much been from this angle of security and protection, and that it's an exchange worth making.
Yeah, it seems like the Snowden stuff sort of rekindled an interest that people did actually have in these issues around the time of the Patriot Act, right? Because it's not like these conversations are entirely new, but it does seem like the apathy that existed back then was rooted in a very different set of assumptions than the apathy that Hannah describes when she talks about presenting this stuff to people. So when you think back to what was going on during the time that the Patriot Act was being debated, people were typically apathetic because they thought, look, this is just not going to apply to me, right? That there are these surveillance tools that are primarily used by the U.S. to identify members of criminal organizations, right, like the mafia. And they were simply looking to extend those security tools and apply them to the war on terrorism, right? And the assumption seemed to be something like, well, if I'm not a part of one of these groups, then I don't have to worry about it, right? Because the government just won't surveil me. So the nothing to hide argument there is slightly different, right, from what we're now talking about, which is more along the lines of, well, even if the government does surveil me, as long as I'm not up to anything malicious, then there's no real reason for me to be concerned about it. There aren't going to be negative consequences for me unless I'm doing something wrong. But it does seem like historically there was a presumption that people didn't want to be surveilled and shouldn't be surveilled unless there was some reason to actually suspect them of being linked to some nefarious organization. I don't know exactly how that changed, what and why people became so generally apathetic in this way. I vividly remember going to a talk right before the Patriot Act was passed where the speaker was explaining some of the ways that the government could potentially infringe on people's privacy. And the example that actually got the audience pretty riled up was kind of laughable today, right? It was just an example of like the government could go and actually request your library records, right? Right. And people in the audience were like, what? That would be an egregious violation of my privacy to have my library records looked at. Because I should be able to read whatever the fuck I want without having to explain myself.
So you described two different versions of the nothing to hide argument and a shift in different kinds of apathy, I guess. So what's the crucial policy difference? So you said initially with the Patriot Act, the idea was that the government could extend its existing surveillance practices in order to detect organized crime. So then the thought was, as you said, people, well, as long as the government doesn't already suspect me of being engaged in organized crime, it's not a problem for me. But is that the extent to which the government uses surveillance in this way?
Well, clearly,
so Snowden, we need to explain the Snowden sort of, you know, stuff.
Right. So clearly not, right? So, I mean, the old presumptions about requiring The old presumption was that probable cause was a prerequisite to being surveilled, right? And the Snowden stuff basically says, look, that prerequisite is barely ever met for the people who are surveilled today, right? The NSA and, you know, various government institutions whose responsibility is to protect, you know, state security are engaging in the surveillance of everyone, regardless of whether or not there's any reason to suspect them. It's in some sense a critical tool to being able to sort the good guys from the bad guys. So clearly, the old presumption that I don't really have to worry about surveillance and I don't really have to worry about my privacy if I'm not already connected to an organization, or if there's no reason for me to, for there to be probable cause or any reason for suspicion about me, those assumptions simply do not apply given the disclosures that Snowden and other whistleblowers have provided.
So the situation, Michael, maybe used to be more like we would recognize from The Wire, the TV series. And so for people who haven't seen The Wire, I have to confess, I only saw The Wire in the last year. So I hadn't seen it. It was one of those things where people were berating me for not having seen it. But
it's taken me one of the great all-time shows.
So on the presumption that most people have seen it, and this wouldn't be spoilery of anything that happens, it's called The Wire because new technology comes about which enables wiretapping on phones, in particular cell phones. And one of the constant frustrations for the main characters of the show is getting legal permission to enable them to get wiretaps installed on persons of interest's phones. And so you can see there, like, this need for evidence that somebody is engaging in criminal activity before you can start surveilling them. Well, the change in policy with the Patriot Act meant that one isn't bound by the same kinds of constraints. And then also something that's called incidental data collection also starts to happen just all over the place, right?
Which
so
is
the
what?
Idea, yeah, so the idea with incidental data collection, so say Michael is a person of interest.
Plausible.
The NSA has reason to be surveilling Michael. Part of what they'll do is they'll start scooping up all of the information that they can about his communication and interaction with other people. And so this will be a pretty vast kind of data trail about who he's been talking to and where he's been going and who he's been interacting with and how long those conversations have been and all of that kind of information. And
I don't talk to that many people.
No, well, so but you do talk to us.
That's true.
And
you guys.
I'm also not an American citizen or resident, right? I have work visa status. So even as a non-American, because I interact with Michael, and then also because you interact with Michael, and then anybody else is interacting with Michael.
We're all fucked.
Well, it's not that we're fucked, but we're not persons of interest. But in trying to scoop up all of the information they can about Michael and who he's talking to, they will also scoop up a whole bunch of information about us. And our information would also get put into these databases. So even though we're not the targets of any particular investigation, significant amounts of information about us, given our interactions with Michael, can also end up in those kinds of data sets. And then importantly, those databases of information can be used and accessed by other government agencies, even if they don't have a legal reason to be interested in investigating us, just completely independent of Michael. Once that information is there, it can be looked at by other agencies.
Yeah, so I mean, that sounds bad, but then there are examples like the way in which we now are doing like data strip searches of Muslims passing through U.S. airports that in some ways are even more egregious than this sort of incidental sort of gathering of information about people, right? Because in a lot of cases now we are simply saying, well, because you come from a country that we've identified as suspicious, we have the right to access all of your data, right? And obviously that doesn't approach anything like probable cause in any sense whatsoever, right? And so there's a sense in which we've just simply done away with the probable cause requirement or reason for suspicion requirements in accessing this data about huge numbers of people.
Two quick footnotes on that. One is a kind of hypocrisy note. So there's been some coverage in the past couple of months that Chinese authorities had been taking people's cell phones at the border and installing software on there to essentially make a copy of what was on these people's phones and then giving it back to them when they didn't know what had been done with their phones. A lot of people, was a lot of commentary that was very upset about this. Note of hypocrisy that we do this in the US. Right. So if you're going to critique the Chinese for doing that, check.
Do it.
Do it.
Like, criticize us too.
Criticize us as well. And then the other is that it's not just Muslims passing through the US that get this, right? This is something that border agents can just do now in the US. So, you know, they can go through your bag, they can look through the papers, they can see the kind of stuff that you're carrying as you go through security. They now can also ask for access to your digital devices, and they may ask for, you know, the password so that they can unlock those devices and look at your data.
So this brings us back nicely to, I'm going to play the sort of devil's advocate here and say, yeah, but what's the problem? I don't have anything to hide. Go ahead. Look at my data. What are you going to find in there? I do a lot of philosophy. Don't look at my data. But if I was a non-philosopher, you know, you're going to see pictures of dogs and kittens and maybe my kids and some bills and I don't know, right? Nothing particularly interesting. And so I trust that the people surveilling me will see that and they'll move on. So let me just reiterate the argument. I think we can sort of state it this way. So the person who thinks that these restrictions on privacy aren't a concern because of the sort of nothing to hide reasons, it's something like this. Look, as long as you're not doing anything wrong or illegal, then there's no harms to you. So good. And if you are doing something wrong, then you shouldn't have privacy over those things anyways. So, right, this kind of surveillance ought to be justified. I mean, when is it problematic? It's not problematic if I haven't done anything, and it's not problematic if I have done something, because then I don't have that privacy. So maybe we should start with the first premise. We can sort of split these up. So first premise, if you're not doing anything wrong or illegal, then there are sort of no bad consequences for you. What do we think about that?
False.
It's just dumb.
What? I don't even know where to start, right? So if you're not doing anything wrong or illegal, there are no harms to you. Thus, you know, so what's the flip side of that? We can infer then that the only reason anybody ever would want to keep anything private is because they're up to no good.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly what it says.
I don't know about, like, there are a lot of normal humanly bodily functions that we don't like other people to witness. Right?
Yeah, right. This is the easy response. It's very strange. If this is meant to be a kind of blanket defense of infringing on security in the name of, infringing on privacy in the name of security. Okay. All right. Then let the government install cameras in your bathroom, in your showers, on your bedside so they can watch you sleep. Right? You have nothing to hide. There's nothing wrong with those things. No problem, right? No, we care deeply about keeping, like, certain things are sensitive for whatever reason, right? And maybe you think, oh, in an ideal world, you know, we wouldn't have these weird social conventions that make pooping so embarrassing. Nevertheless, we do, so.
Well, any number of other things.
Sure.
Right? There are lots of things. So it's just,
pooping's just the funniest, I'm sorry.
Well, people also don't like to pee where others can see them. A lot of people don't want other people to see, like, some people when they put their makeup on. They can only do it when they stick their tongue out on a funny angle. I'm not one of those people, but I've had friends who had to do this.
That's interesting, and you just added them.
Well, no, and they're probably not listening to this anyway. But, wow. You know, I mean, that's not wrong. It's not illegal. It's just kind of quirky and weird.
You know, it's a good one for people with partners or are married. All the silly things you say to your partner.
Right.
That you know, are just completely silly that you don't, like, you know, other people, A, don't want to hear, but B, you don't want them to hear.
Right.
It's very much contrasts with your very serious public facing persona.
Right, Michael.
Yeah, I'm just thinking of the fact, like, every time that I say to Amy, how did you get to be such a serious person? Anything that preceded that.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, wrongness and illegalness are not just simply not the only reason for why you want to keep something private. And you may not want to keep it private because it's anything immoral. It could just be embarrassing or shameful. Even if the embarrassment and the shame that you might experience from that thing being known isn't, like, justified shame or embarrassment, or, like, the world would be a better place if people didn't find those kinds of things embarrassing or not. Yeah, but you're talking about ideals now, and we're trying to talk about what happens to real people in their lives, right? So it would perhaps be better if everybody communally defecated. Like, I'm not convinced.
I did not expect this podcast to go in this direction.
Like, I know that people have done that in the past, and I know that there are places where people were perfectly fine doing that. No rational argument is going to change my attitude towards
you get
this.
Something close to that anytime if you go hiking and you're like, you stay at you go to a public restroom or like a cabin up on a mountain. The old sort of hiking men there are the closest approximation that I've discovered in Western civilization. They just don't care about anything.
But they've just given up.
Well, see, but even designating it as giving up is like signaling that for most people, they would rather keep this private.
Okay, yes. Well, so what about other than embarrassment and shame and sort of things like that, are there other concerns for if you're someone who's doesn't have anything sort of deeply immoral or illegal to hide. Are there concerns about the consequences that could result from government surveillance? I mean, surely there are cases, we know of cases where people have been wrongly suspected of very bad things, in part because of this. So that's, right, it's a low chance, but well, it has happened.
Yeah, so like the, if you're being constantly surveilled, then that opens up the possibility for a lot of misinterpretation of what you're doing and why you're doing it. And so if nobody had been watching, they wouldn't have seen you doing innocuous things. But because somebody is watching, and because inferring people's intentions and what they're about to do is very difficult, you can open up the possibility for a lot of misinterpretations, thinking that people are behaving weirdly or suspiciously when they're not, right? So that's certainly a possible threat. If somebody suddenly just decides to stop using, I don't know, Facebook or something like that, somebody who's surveilling might take that to be a sign of something suspicious or dubious or something like that.
Discuss, God forbid, you're like talking about a video game where there's warfare involved and you talk about what you were doing in it.
Well, I was gonna say that's why Toby's completely fucked. Yeah. If your data is being picked up
and you're right, in conjunction with being connected to you, yeah. No, that's
yeah,
right.
We've talked about Dark Souls for hours.
Great game.
Yeah. But you know, I don't know, it's hard if we're restricting to government surveillance, then it is difficult. If we were talking about all kinds of surveillance, it's all kinds
of weird behaviors. We'll get there.
So even for government surveillance, I mean, you said you asked the question in the form of if we're excluding actions that are shameful, embarrassing, or sort of illegal or whatever. So even if you exclude those, there is still sort of mundane information that the government might end up acquiring about you that could end up leading the government to make decisions about you that are harmful to you, right? Like even that, some fairly innocuous government surveillance could actually be bad for people.
Give us an example.
So I was thinking the government, things related to government making health decisions for people and the kind of investment the government should make in a person's health. If it's sort of tracking your diet, right, seeing how you spend your money. I'm thinking of the stuff that Virginia Eubanks talks about in some of the early chapters of her book, where she sort of lays out the ways in which the government is effectively surveilling the poor and how they use their food stamps, right? Like, that then leads the government to be able to make these decisions about how it's going to support you that often are actually very bad for the people that it should be helping out the most. And they're not doing anything shameful or anything like that. They're simply, you know, going to the store and buying things to, you know, support themselves. And yet the government often will use that information against them and to justify cutting funds for the poor and things like that. So I think there's a lot of ways in which even if you're totally moral in how you live your life, it's still possible that really mundane information can be used by the government to sort of control your life, as well as to potentially make funding decisions that are going to be harmful to you. And we have clear cases of that.
And this might be a little bit more kind of high church philosophy kind of argument to make at this point as well, but just looking at the consequences is only one way to evaluate the harms or not of surveillance. And so one might think that there is something problematic about the attitude the government takes towards its citizens when it takes them to be objects that should be surveilled and monitored and constantly evaluated and judged, rather than persons deserving of freedom and space to live their lives as they see fit. So there also can be concerns about the kind of objectification of the population by the government. And that's independent of any particular consequences, right? It's an issue of respect. And so Michael Lynch, a philosopher, is someone who has made a couple of different arguments to this effect, both in response to government surveillance. So, you know, one argument's more concerned about access to the content of our own minds and our independence in that way. The more recent version of this argument concerns autonomy and the attitudes that autonomous persons are deserving of.
So, interesting. So, first premise is false. The premise, if you're not doing anything wrong or illegal, then there's really no harms to you. One, it increases your risk for a number of sort of consequential harms that could occur. And there is this kind of perhaps intrinsic harm where you're not being treated with the proper respect that autonomous persons are owed. Let's move to premise two, though. This one's interesting. This idea, well, if you are doing something wrong or illegal, then you shouldn't have privacy over the wrong or illegal things anyways. So maybe the surveillance of innocent people is problematic, but maybe one might still think, but the surveillance of people who are not innocent, who do have things to hide, that's not problematic. What do we think about that?
That's so encompassing of a principle, right? Because you've got the illegal stuff, right? So any illegal activity, you are not entitled to keep private. But then the really broad part of that disjunction there is wrong stuff. So any wrongdoing that you're engaging in, even if it's not illegal wrongdoing, it's just like immoral wrongdoing, or I don't know, maybe impolite wrongdoing.
You're just rude to somebody.
Right. Then you don't have any privacy over that either. I mean, how expensive is that? If I'm writing really, what was that film? Harriet's Diary? Oh, main character, I think her name's Harriet, She has a diary. She writes a bunch of stuff in there about her peers. And some of it's not very nice. She's like primary school or intermediate school or something. And the diary is found. And then everybody gets really angry at her for having written these judgmental things down in her diary. And like by premise two, assuming that it's wrong to write judgmental, critical things of other people, she's not allowed to keep that diary private. It's wrong of her to try to keep it private.
Yeah. Maybe we should, I mean, that one is crazy.
Well, it's totally, your thing though is totally, it's not just a film. So like today when old people pass away, their families inherit their like massive catalog of diaries. This happens with my family anyway. And then
that's weird, people, man.
No, it is weird, but at the same time, what you're describing is it's not just a sort of fictional film scenario. It's something that really does happen. And I don't think, like, my family doesn't actually consider the privacy implications of being like, oh, now we're going to read all of the intimate thoughts of
Wait, do they
person.
Read it too? They inherit?
Yes.
That, no, yes. See, that should be cremated along with the person.
I agree.
And family members know this ahead of time and continue to write in their journals?
See, that part I don't know. I'm not... I don't think that there is an intention that they will be made publicly available. Certainly not in some cases, because they would not have written the things that they have written.
Oh, Lord. This is an incredibly risky practice for a family.
Yeah, you're right.
That's hilarious. But another non-fictional example of this is the Ashley Madison scandal. My understanding of Ashley Madison is that this was a website for people who were in relationships, either married or in serious committed long-term relationships, to discreetly, they had hoped, find other also married individuals and engage in affairs on the side. Famously, Ashley Madison had a huge data breach, and this revealed the names of all the people who had been using the service.
Oops.
So, I mean, there's sort of a... it's hard with these kinds of examples because I think for anybody who's been cheated on, right, you do feel like you're entitled to that information. The partner doesn't deserve to keep that private or something. So it's a little bit tricky. But I think we should be wary of endorsing that premise in its fullest extent, right?
Right.
So, I mean, do people actually think, though, that they are entitled to that information, or do they think that everyone is entitled to that information, right? Because those data breaches aren't about just, the offended parties it doesn't just involve those parties actually acquiring this information. It means that it's publicly available to everybody to scrutinize the behavior of their cheating partners.
Right. I'm not sure. Given the number of reality TV programs that exist to catch people in the act of cheating, and I don't know how real those are. But there's certainly an attitude that something like cheaters have no rights
right.
seems to be what those kinds of shows suggest.
If this is a special case because, right, so someone might say, well, I screw cheaters not just because they're doing something wrong, but perhaps because we take them to have made a special commitment to their partner, which gives that partner special rights over their activities or something, with some limitations. Surely we don't think that spouses and partners can just constantly surveil, but I wonder if that's kind of a, they might say this is a kind of a different case for that reason.
I mean, the other thing about the Ashley Madison example is that for at least some people, I would imagine these were sort of ethical non-monogamous relationships. Mm-hmm. Right. I don't know that it actually was exclusively for people who regarded were in relationships where their partners would actually regard what they were doing as wrong. So it's...
Even if it was, they couldn't enforce that, obviously. So right. Surely there are some people... Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, in some ways, it's a counterexample to both premises.
Right.
For at least some people, maybe were not engaging in unethical behavior, and yet they had good reason to not want that information made public.
Well, okay, so maybe, right, so typically the law isn't as stringent as morality, right? The law doesn't require that you not be rude to people and that you be nice to everyone or even that you be faithful to your spouse. So what about cases of illegality? And you may think that, you know, maybe the government has a special, I don't know, permissions when it comes to people engaging in an illegal activity. I guess one thing I'd like to point out is that, I don't know, it seems like there's an interesting parallel to due process here. So one of the consequences, as we've said, of expanding surveillance and shrinking privacy is to increase the likelihood of false positives, right? So the chances that you will be wrongly suspected to be engaged in illegal activity. And there's a parallel to due process here because we tend to think that false positives are really bad in the context of criminal justice, right? It's really, really bad if an innocent person is punished via imprisonment or worse. And so due process is in part a way to protect against that for two reasons. One of the ways it does this is sort of epistemic. The fair trial is a way of collecting information so that we can make a better judgment about whether someone actually committed a crime or not, because it can be hard to know. But then the other thing is just that we know historically really powerful entities like governments, if they have too much power over something like criminal justice, then they will be prone to increasing the number of false positives, either because it's just convenient for them to imprison someone, or historically also in the name of security, right? There's sort of an increasing emphasis on security and other values like privacy and due process could be sacrificed. So it seems like privacy can be justified for criminals, for people, anyone who's doing illegal activities for the same kinds of reasons. We recognize that, it's bad if people get away with committing crimes, especially if they're harming other people, but it's worse to have a government which generates too many false positives. And so privacy is one of these safeguards against proliferating false positives.
One example to think of here is the short story by Philip K. Dick, Minority Report, also made into a film, The Minority Report, which most people are probably familiar with that rather than the short story, Scott Tom Cruise.
With the cool sequences of him manipulating those highfalutin UI stuff.
Yeah.
Which is really the only thing I really remember from that movie. They really wanted to push that.
Yeah, well, that's right at the start of the film. So it also grabs you right at the beginning. He's moving a lot of this stuff around in space to use this fancy. I actually, just as a total side tangent, nobody wants see-through computer screens or monitors. Nobody wants that. Nobody wants to be working on a transparent sheet of glass where you can see the outside distracting you away. So can we just make sure that just doesn't happen? What could be worse than that?
Why do people find that so impressive looking? You're right. Hollywood writer is like, what are you doing?
Anyway, that's not the point. But the point is that for most people, The Minority Report is a dystopian fiction, right? So the central premise of the Minority Report universe is that there are certain people who are known as precogs. They have precognitive abilities. They can see the future. And so the precogs are wired in to this artificial intelligence system, gathering all of this information about possible criminal activities in the future. And then the surveillance state of the government of this dystopian future captures people and puts them in prison before they can actually commit the crimes. And for a lot of people, that kind of future is terrifying, right? It just feels like overstepping a boundary. And apart for these due process reasons, right? You're not meant to penalize non-criminals. And the Minority Report future gives us one where we imprison potential criminals. We've got a little bit of magic in there with the precogs, right? Because the thought is they're not going to get anything wrong. We don't have the magic of precogs. We just have you know, predictive models that aggregate a whole bunch of information about you and who you've been talking to and attempt to infer whether or not you're going to do criminal stuff in the future. And that can have very real consequences for people, namely people who are currently in prison, who actually do have their cases run through predictive algorithms like this to determine whether or not they should be given parole, right? These are recidivism risk algorithms.
Yeah, so, just to be clear, those are really interesting cases because you have people who have already committed a crime and their prison term could be shorter or longer depending on their perceived risk, which will be calculated from various facts about them.
And other people similarly like them as well. And so partly, you know, we can sort of feel the appeal of having tools like this. Like if we could stop crimes before they could happen, wouldn't that be great? But there's also a risk. No system is perfect. So if we really care about not punishing and penalizing people who haven't done anything wrong, then we do need to be worried about this very pervasive, predictive uses of surveillance technology, because they are looking at what non-criminals are doing and trying to determine whether or not they're likely to do criminal things. So you are being typed, I guess, by the algorithms.
I mean, yeah. So what you have basically described is just the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution, right? Like, I'll pull it up and read it for you.
Please. So it'll be our first Constitution reading on the podcast.
So the right of the... Yeah, right. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable search and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. Right? So, in other words, the government, suppose somebody is trafficking drugs, right, and they're concealing drugs in their home. If the government like goes in to their home and finds said drugs and then arrests them, well, that doesn't mean that it was actually a legal search or that that evidence can be used if the government had no reason in the first place to actually suspect that the drugs were actually in their home, right? So the mere fact that they are criminals doesn't undermine the presumption of a right to privacy that they had before the government intruded upon that right. And so, in other words, you even if you are doing something illegal, it does not follow that you don't have a right to privacy.
And why have this protection in place in the first place?
For all the reasons that you were describing.
Yeah. I mean, so Hannah put it mildly, right? She said, like, no system is perfect. No, we know that these systems of surveillance and punishment are massively, wildly imperfect, right, and predictable ways. And so this is why you have these kinds of legal rights recognized and enshrined in a constitution.
And predictable ways along important protected classes, right? So predictably wrong along race lines, predictably wrong along gender lines, predictably wrong along class lines, which
historically political lines.
I mean, political lines.
Oh, it could be anything. Right. They're just bad. Like people, when governments with too much power do what's convenient. But yeah, that would also have these. We know it currently has these other faults along those other lines as mm-hmm. well.
So I mean, the way we've been talking about the constitutional sort of point and these issues around due process still grants the intuition that privacy really is about surveillance and security and monitoring. But I think as we've shown with sort of the Minority Report style concerns, privacy isn't just about surveillance. And so there is a law professor and researcher, Daniel Solove, who's done quite a lot of work on complicating the concept of privacy. And in particular, critiquing the nothing to hide argument. And he's got a really nice slogan that I drop whenever I can, which is too many people thinking about privacy, thinking about Orwell. So too much Orwell, not enough Kafka. And by Orwell, he means 1984. And by Kafka, he means the trial. And so what happens in the trial is somebody gets swept into this bureaucratic machine. They're being charged with something. They don't know why. They don't know what information is had on them. They can't see into the process. It's completely untransparent. And so when we start thinking about privacy in the Kafka sense with the trial, we start to realize that it's not just about surveillance. It's about information processing, massive capture of information, the ways that that information is then manipulated. He breaks it down, I think, into, I'm trying to remember the size of the table, but I think he gives 16 distinct kinds of privacy concerns that one could have once you start sort of opening up this question about, okay, if it's not just about surveillance, why else might we care about privacy? So for like anyone who's interested in looking at a pretty detailed exploration of what privacy means when we're not just thinking about surveillance, I think that that solid piece is quite nice.
Which we'll link to on badlandsphilosophy.com. That's badlandsphilosophy.com, your place for links to Daniel Soloff's articles on privacy. I'm just practicing for when we have sponsors. Okay, so let's put aside the nothing to hide argument now. It doesn't succeed in showing that we shouldn't care about government surveillance. And as Hannah pointed out, it's not all about surveillance. Anyhow, so it seems like we should care about these restrictions to privacy for all the reasons we discussed. But lots of present-day privacy crises don't concern security or even necessarily the government. So let's talk about other ways that our privacy is undermined and whether or not there's good reason to care about those underminings of privacy.
I mean, yeah, I think it's useful to point out that the privacy concerns people typically have are really focused on sensitive information that they can imagine corporations and others acquiring about themselves, like their browsing histories, the stuff like that was revealed in the Ashley Madison case. I do think it's helpful to point out that it's not just governments who are collecting all of that data, right? But it's corporations and actually other sort of even sort of public institutions are amassing massive amounts of data about us that are presumably very sensitive that we wouldn't want other people to know about us. Hannah has a bunch of useful examples.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know where to start, but there's a collection of related examples that I think people can see as being problematic, not because they are, you know, they're not dick pics, but they, you know, everybody's concerned. I say that because I think it was Last Week Tonight by John Oliver. They had an episode where they were talking about privacy and they interviewed Edward Snowden, and the way that they made the issues salient for the audience is to frame all of the privacy concerns in terms of dick pics. And so people care very much about the fact that their dick pics might be seen. And
I wonder if that backfires for a young male audience.
Let's leave that aside. Right. So there are those kinds of there are those kinds of concerns. And I think people are worried about that kind of information getting caught. But again, that kind of gets into the shame and embarrassment sort of area. So here's some examples, and they're a little bit dated now, but we could, I think, quite easily find many more recent examples of similar data infringements. So there was a company called CloudPets, and CloudPets have a kind of like new Furby kind of device, where this is like a robot toy that your kids might have, and that you can, as a parent, record images, like video and recordings for your child for when you go away, so they can still have video of you and listen to you reading their bedtime stories and things like that. So the CloudPets recordings were actually uploaded to a cloud database, and it wasn't secure. So hackers were able to access, you know, close to a million voice messages that parents and children had recorded on these toys. In 2015, this happened again with another company, VTech, 5 million parents and children's messages to one another, including selfies and private messages, was revealed. Was revealed also in 2015 that the...
6 days later. By your dates here.
Yeah. that a new kind of Barbie doll, the Hello Barbie doll, could eavesdrop on kids. And then in 2017, another one of these nanny cam type soft toys was revealed to be hackable with the cameras and the microphones that it has. I mean, that's kind of unsurprising, I guess, that these toys have these kinds of vulnerabilities. I mean, their nanny cams are for a reason. It's so parents can spy on the people who are looking after their kids. But even when it's not actually a spy device by design, sort of sensitive.
The tools are there.
Right. Yeah, the tools are there, and the data stored online is accessible. So.
Yeah, so those are nice examples. Those are examples where it's not about embarrassment, it's not about shame, doing anything wrong or anything like that. Rather, it's people watching your kids or listening to your kids.
Yeah, like weird people, you know, and that's just, ugh.
And also just like the just like intimate moments that you have with other people.
Right. So actually, to do a callback to the Judith Jarvis Thompson paper that quote you opened with comes from, she has a really nice thought experiment in there where she says, imagine a thief comes through your house and they steal some of your stuff and leave. All right, we've imagined that. Imagine this instead. Somebody breaks into your house and they quite clearly go through all of your belongings looking at everything, but they don't take anything away.
Ugh.
Yeah, and it just, you know, I've found this in talking about it when I've taught it, that there is something really creepy and unnerving about the idea that somebody's just come into your house and gone through all of your stuff, and you don't know why. If they'd stolen something, at least you would have had, okay, they're just here to sort of, you know, take my PlayStation or something, right? There's something deeply unsettling about somebody just looking at all of your stuff, going through all of it. No, you know, they're just kind of in there. I don't know. And yeah. I think that that's a nice example for helping demonstrate that we're invested in privacy for reasons that don't have to do with the consequences. There's an invasion of personal private space that really matters to us. And it's not clear to me that that is irrational or unjustified, right? The desire for having those kinds of private spaces where you can choose what's shared with other people or not.
Right.
Sounds right. All right, great. So there are things that have nothing to do with security or wrongdoing, and we still, because we value privacy sort of itself, which is just evident in people's reactions to these kinds of situations, there can be reasons to care about collections of sensitive information. But what about information that's not sensitive? What about information that's boring and mundane? I think probably most plausibly this comes up with the kind of data that's collected about us by online advertisers, right, to use to target their ads at us. Really boring stuff. I mean, it depends, right? If it's like browsing history, that could be both, but plausibly lots of it is stuff that isn't sensitive, that we don't really care about per se. Are there reasons to care about that kind of stuff being collected about us? Yes. After all, I get targeted ads and those ads are better.
Yeah, well, what I was thinking is that it's not
though?
I don't know.
No,
it
actually
depends, dude.
No, like, it's not.
Hang on.
No. There have been studies that show that, like, at most it's like a 1% to 2% benefit increase for companies ahead.
No, I don't mean like that. I mean, like, I don't have to, like, watch advertisements for, like, pickup trucks or cheap beer. Like, that is a benefit to me.
Is it, though? Again, like, a lot of times it's trying to sell you shit you don't actually need. Maybe when it is effective, is it better for you to now be pointed in the direction of some?
Now it's a tough trade-off. Now it's the manipulation of more effective manipulation of me, but I get a more enjoyable manipulative experience.
Right.
So it's trade-off, Michael.
Well, I mean, what I was thinking is that you phrased it in terms of online surveillance, but actually, I'm sure any time you use your credit card, it is being hooked into that big advertising nexus. So if you really wanted to get away from this, you need to use cash and no loyalty cards. And then hope like hell that there isn't in-store facial recognition that's connecting you to everything anyway.
And not have your phone with you.
Yeah, and not have your phone with you with the GPS.
Because every time that I go to a store or a bar or anything here, when I leave, I'm asked to rate that place.
Yes. Yeah. And so that's kind of... I'm not sure if it's mundane information. I mean, certainly it's not like immoral and illegal kinds of information that might be being gathered. But...
Well, I mean, there's a difference in the quality of it. It's not sensitive in the same way that some of this other stuff is. Like, if I buy 2 pounds of potatoes, like, it's weird if other people know about it, but I'm not like, oh my God, you're watching my kids.
Right. And in some cases, it really is. So it's true that some of that information might not be mundane, but like in the example of universities trying to predict which students it should admit, a lot of that information is actually, you'd think, mundane, right? It's like, what geographic region do I live in?
Mm-hmm.
And sort of how much time do I spend on different sections of their site? Like, that information almost only has instrumental value to them, isn't the kind of thing that you really would care to protect. Some of it you probably would initially maybe even volunteer up if you didn't realize that they were going to then use that information to make decisions about you.
Mm-hmm.
Or the case you just described earlier about state governments maybe perhaps using mundane information about you to infer facts about your health and thus determine the kinds of healthcare benefits you're eligible for or something like that.
Right.
So it's worth saying that, you know, we've talked about government surveillance and then some of these specific like companies that are doing surveillance. But if we talked about the advertising nexus, that is, I believe, far larger an enterprise of surveilling and monitoring individuals' behaviors and then, you know, classifying that and inferring certain things about them and da-da-da than any of those, than government surveillance. And in fact, this is quite easily shown by the number of devices that sort of private companies now being looped into things like police departments. So Amazon Ring, for instance, very popular doorbell / security camera for houses, is now also being used by local police departments as kind of like a neighborhood watch kind of integration program. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's just the sort of private industry data collection is often so good and so vast and has been adopted by so many that it makes sense for the government to actually buy into what those companies know and gather about us.
And just to be clear, for people who haven't listened to a lot of the earlier episodes, I am sort of in principle opposed to advertising, period. so and on the grounds of, I don't know what it is other than manipulation. So to the extent that the collection of data is meant to increase their ability to manipulate me and others, I'm against it. Just to be clear, I was just sort of playing devil's advocate in a goofy kind of way earlier. But people who are longtime listeners probably know this. I think I've had more than one rant about advertising.
I assume that you were getting money on the side.
Nope. Definitely not.
Yeah.
Which is another interesting angle, right? I mean, it's something to consider perhaps in the future, whether this constitutes exploitation, right?
Yeah.
The way that you're sort of like, for instance, your online browsing activity can be collected and then sold.
Mm-hmm.
Which is interesting, without any benefit to you, other than those sweet targeted ads that you get.
I think that is
how they spin it, by the way. We're making a better advertising experience for the consumer.
It is. And then when you check the box to turn off targeted ads, like on Amazon, for instance, you can turn parts of that off. It does give you a box that says, you know, are you sure you want to sign in to not get ads targeted to you? Well, so it seems like the targeted advertising stuff is not worth the investment for a lot of companies that do it. And so if it's not worth the investment for them, somebody still has an interest in keeping it going. That's not really where I want to go at that point, but I want to not talk about that, and I want to talk about the next thing. Yeah, so I mean, all the talk about advertising, sort of one side of the coin, and it intersects interestingly with something I mentioned right at the beginning when I was just giving a list off of the kinds of privacy concerns we might have. And this is the in-school surveillance. So we know that many schools have security cameras now, but as schools are becoming more technologically advanced, they're also doing things like giving all of the students Chromebooks or tablets to use in the classroom. And those can have real-time surveillance by teachers, so teachers can see what students are looking at and what they're doing. And that might not, in principle, sound too bad. I mean, it might not feel too different from what teachers are meant to be doing anyway, keeping students
on
task.
They walk around the room and look over your shoulder, and right. You, like, tense up, and you're like, oh, God.
sorry.
Which illustrates
thinking, like,
the point.
It's an interesting kind of avenue for... if we're thinking about life as a video game, for like deception and your int stat and things like this, right? Trying to get away, all the things you have to try to do to get away with passing notes in class. Because you have to be able to write them in a way where you don't get noticed. And then you also have to be able to pass them physically around the room without getting seen. And so we're robbing students, this whole new generation of kids, from the ability to develop these kinds of skills. That's not the real concern. But so there's a report, I think it's 2015, by the Electronic Frontier Foundation, where they did a kind of deep dive into the use of these kinds of new technologies in classrooms, all the ways in which, in many places, parents are not being asked to give consent for their student for their kids to start using these technologies in classrooms. So parental consent is not being given for this kind of surveillance of their kids. And there's a lot of quotes from kids and teachers and even other members of the school staff and things like this about the impact that it's having. One of the ones that really stuck out for me in reading that report is some comments from students that they feel creatively restricted. So they report what we call chilling effects from the knowledge that they're being watched. So they're modifying their behavior because they are being surveilled.
Like they do when the teacher walks behind him and you cringe up. It's like having that constantly.
Right. But things like, you know, interfering with the creative process. So because they know that somebody is reading or potentially watching what they're writing, they're not going to write what they otherwise would have written. Right.
As so an then... adult, just writing for you guys, I won't write if I knew you guys were watching me writing the episode in real time. I would feel weird about that.
Right. So, you know, chilling effects are something that we've barely talked about. But again, to call back to something mentioned right at the start of the episode, this is part of what people are really concerned about with CCTV cameras. Everybody's going to be acting weird and unnatural, and they're going to feel surveilled and uncomfortable in public spaces when they know that Big Brother is over their shoulder watching.
Not to mention when they check books out of the library.
Right, exactly. Think about the things you wouldn't get out from the library if you thought...
My God, we've talked about anarchism on this podcast. What a mistake.
And panopticism is the term for this, as it's discussed and researched. And this is named after a building design by Jeremy Bentham, you know, old favorite philosopher, right, of all of ours. I'm just kidding. I don't know if any of us have a particular affinity for Bentham. But anyway, the panopticon, yeah. Right, being a building... circular in design with a central tower with a guard who may or may not be present. But if you're in one of the rooms around the outside of the circle of the building, you can never be sure if you're being watched or not. And this was a proposal for schools and hospital wards and prisons. And this metaphor was taken up by Michel Foucault and others to talk about the ways that surveillance is used to discipline the society, so that members of the society will start to modify their own behavior, even when there's no real, you know, there's no guard in the tower, right? They're not actually being watched. So surveillance has disciplining effects on people that modifies their behavior in ways that we might think is problematic.
This is a great example of, traditional utilitarian disregard for rights.
Yeah.
What an efficient outcome.
Yeah, and it is efficient, right? Imagine if all the kids in school just started behaving at their best. Well, then you start to get some of those dystopian scenarios where everybody is behaving in exactly the same way and, you know, da-da-da. Watch first episode of one of the recent seasons of Black Mirror, right, where all social interaction is mediated by points you get from other people. So everybody has this artificial kindness and over-the-top happiness towards everybody else because they're trying to accumulate social capital because they know that absolutely everything that they're doing is being surveilled.
I mean, and look, some people, you know, might think that's fine, but then you just have to acknowledge that you're deeply un-American. I mean, what can we say, right? If our, you know, one of our core values is liberty, then that's going to be incompatible with this, just to remind, you know, us of the things that we care about.
Yeah, I mean, and for non-Americans, I mean, it's just,
oh, yeah, right. Other people care about liberty, too, I forgot.
Wait, you do?
Is it true?
Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah, it's just like, it's just none of your business.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah.
But how do you stay safe?
Oh, you know, she'll be right.
Okay, she'll be right.
But, I mean, safety is important. And so let's just bring it down to, I guess, one final topic for discussion, right? So, like, you can be motivated to care about giving up your privacy because this is going to make everybody safer. But it turns out that actually not caring about your privacy is a way to make certain people less safe. One actually can just come straight away from the sort of in-school surveillance. Turns out, even without school surveillance, that minority students tend to be penalized and disciplined at higher rates than their white peers. And that trend is seemingly exacerbated with the use of even more inclusive surveillance, like looking at what students are doing real time on their computers. So not caring about privacy can actually contribute to the over-surveillance of certain people. Even in, we're talking about schools, we see that effect. And that that kind of principle or moral just generalizes out. So not caring about, or taking the attitude of I have nothing to hide as the right way to approach privacy means that for people who might otherwise be the targets of overburdened surveillance, they will be surveilled even more and at higher rates. And they may not have anything to hide either, but there is a presumption against them, right, that they do have something to hide. So the digital strip search example that we discussed earlier is a good case of this. For many travelers, or even obviously by far the majority of travelers, they're not doing anything illegal. They're going home to see their family for the holidays or something like that. But a culture of general apathy about surveillance means that things like digital strip searches come into existence and that those people who are Muslim or are from a Muslim country or any other countries of interest that the American government might have particular reason to be
or Michael
concerned about, or being Michael, means that you will get targeted by these more invasive practices of privacy checking and things like that than you otherwise would have were they not in place.
So your thought is, well, look, the initial response that we were discussing and trying to combat is one of apathy, and it's a self-centered apathy, right? It's like, well, I don't see what the problem is for me, so I don't see what I have to, why I should care. I'll happily give up my privacy. Even for someone who does think that, I mean, there's 2 points. One, even if that were true of you, you shouldn't take that to be a general argument in favor of everyone being relaxed about privacy, because not everyone might be as lucky as you are. But second, your waiving your own privacy can contribute to invasions of other people's privacy, which can be harmful for them. So it's not just a kind of self-centered obligation you might have. The thought is you have an obligation to other people to protect, perhaps, or fight for their and your privacy.
Right. So we just know that there are certain individuals who are more likely to be surveilled and taken to be persons of interest by the government, and even by companies, right? Advertising companies who do targeted advertising on vulnerable populations. Not caring about privacy yourself, or not setting high standards of care about your own privacy because you're not personally at risk at a loss of privacy, can be directly contributing to harming others who are targets of certain either targeted advertising or government surveillance programs. And so that, I think, is a problem that we should be concerned about as well, right? Privacy isn't just about you. Privacy is about people who are similar to you, for one case I mentioned earlier, right? And then it's also really important for people who are not at all like you. but your apathy, especially if you're somebody who's in a position of social power, right, as us sort of white, well-educated members of this podcast are, right, our not caring has much greater effects for people who are not similarly socially situated. And so that could be, you know, a pretty serious neglect of our responsibility and duties of care to those others.
So you can start by getting a password manager.
Password manager.
Step one.
Step one.
There's a lot of great options out there.
Take, unplug that Amazon Echo from the wall. Disable the Ring, you know.
Not one of our potential future sponsors, so go ahead.
Yeah, no, not gonna. Yeah. I wouldn't stand for it.
No. Well, they wouldn't either. Well, though, you wonder if you know, I mean, will advertisers ever, you know, get sort of, have some more courage, have some more spine, and say, you know what, we're going to sponsor something that is critical of us because we are open to criticism. No, probably not.
Probably not. I'm just, yeah, I mean, people, they do that, but...
Really?
I mean, companies do stuff like that, and then everybody's kind of, like, cynical and, oh, it's just a publicity stunt. They're pretending to care about this thing that is going to harm them because aren't they bigger than their profits, but actually it's really just for their profits.
Fascinating.
We just get into that cycle. I mean, this is Friedman's take on companies that actually do invest in social causes. It's hypocritical of them. They can do it, but we should all acknowledge that it's hypocritical. Yeah.
I feel like there's only, for all the podcasts I listen to, there's like five advertisers, right? Some point we just, yeah. It's like,
the mattress one.
ZipRecruiter.
ZipRecruiter.
Yeah. Where?
Yep.
Let's not give them free advertising. We don't need to talk about them. You just bleep over the name that Michael just said.
This is right.
Okay, so we've given a lot of reasons. Hannah's primarily given a lot of reasons for thinking that privacy is valuable and that we should care about it both for our own well-being and others. But then there's this really other big question, which was the one we sort of started with and I said we're going to talk about next episode, which is, well, okay, privacy is valuable, but what are the rights that we have with respect to privacy and when are those rights violated? Right. So just because something is good and valuable doesn't mean that it is to be protected at all costs. There's times when it can be overridden. So, for instance, we know that liberty is a good thing. Right. On balance, it's good as if we can act the way we want to. But we recognize that there are all kinds of limitations on liberty, which are perfectly fine. Right. It's not always the case that restrictions on liberty violate some right of ours, or take whatever your favorite right is. Right. For your right to free speech or something like that. We think that there are limitations on basically every right, property rights, which we discussed in the past couple of episodes. So there's an open possibility in a lot of the cases that we've discussed that while, yes, our privacy is shrunk, it's infringed upon, it's reduced, it could be that none of our privacy rights are violated, if there even are such things, right? Probably some people are skeptical that we even have those. So that would be an interesting outcome. So in the next episode, we're going to talk about, well, what rights do we have with respect to privacy? And then we can maybe come down on a lot of these cases and decide whether they are privacy rights violations. Or more honestly, we'll explain to you why we think that they are violations of privacy, at least in most cases.
But it's important to sort of answer this more detailed question, because what we definitely don't want to be the case is that we're just like... grossed out by privacy, like by people knowing stuff about us, and it turns out on closer inspection that like we have no good reason to actually be worried about that. We just don't like it, and it's a generational problem, and all these young people live streaming their entire lives to the internet are actually on the right side of this. So like I would be very interested to know if that's the case, because my intuitions certainly tell me that no, they just don't understand the consequences of what they're doing. but, you know, I could be proved wrong.
And there's going to be cases that are genuinely difficult, where it's just tough to say, okay, privacy is sort of restricted, but is there a violation to it right here? We'll get that next time, though. So thanks, guys, for that chat. That was fun.
Yeah, thank you.
Go ahead and delete that Dalmatian picture, though. It doesn't matter. I already have it. It's too late.
No, it's already out there.
It's already out there. You're screwed. All right. Well, see you guys next time.
See ya.
See ya.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Badlands Politics and Philosophy Podcast. If you're enjoying the podcast, you can help it grow by subscribing and by giving it a good rating or a review. And don't forget to check out our website, badlandsphilosophy.com, where you can find a list of citations for every episode and access written content that we post there regularly. If you want to get in touch with us, you can do that through our website, and you can also find us on Twitter at the Badlands Pod. Thanks again for listening.